It's Saturday, July 26th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with David Joss. David is the author of two short story collections, Black Maps and Crimes of Passion, two collections of poems, Improvising Rivers and You Are Not Here, and a collection of essays on the craft of fiction, Alone with All That Could Happen. He has also edited two anthologies, Strong Measures, Contemporary American Poetry in Traditional Forms, and The Best of Crazy Horse, 30 Years of Poetry and Fiction. A third anthology, Words Overflown by Stars, contains essays of the craft of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction by past and present Vermont College of Fine Arts faculty members, and will be published this December. His fiction and poetry have appeared in numerous magazines and been reprinted in Best American Short Stories, Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards, the Pushcart Prize, Best of the Small Presses, the Pushcart Book of Stories, Best Stories from the First 25 Years of the Pushcart Prize, Strongly Spent, 50 Years of Shenandoah Poetry, the Poetry Anthology, 1912 to 2002, and elsewhere. He served as fiction editor of Crazy Horse for 10 years and is currently on the editorial board of Vermont College's literary journal, Hunger Mountain. The recipient of the AWP Award for Short Fiction, the Fleur-de-Lis Poetry Prize, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and a James A. Michener Fellowship, among other awards. He teaches at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and in the MFA in Writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts, where he also serves as faculty chair. I interviewed Dave in June during the Vermont College MFA in Writing summer residency. I began by asking him how he came to be a writer.
I think everyone writes when they're young, and writers are just the people who don't stop. I have kept on doing it. I like to write and make up stories when I was little, and I just kept doing it. I never thought it was something that one could actually make a living at. I thought it was just some impractical part of my life. But it's become my life.
At what point did it start to seem like it would become a career?
I think I could actually trace it down to one day. I took a creative writing class in college, and just because I wanted to. I didn't expect to major in English or anything of that sort. And the teacher, who was Stephen Dunn, recently won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. I was very lucky to have him as my first teacher. Suggested I send the first story I wrote off to the Atlantic. Now, this was very premature, but that kind of encouragement meant a great deal to me. And then I had another English professor who called me to his office. I thought he was going to tell me that I didn't have the prerequisites to be in his class, because it was an upper-level course, and I was too naive to know that the different numbers meant, you know, senior level as opposed to freshman and so forth, and I was just a freshman in the class. And he asked me what I planned to do with my life, and I said I wasn't entirely sure. And he said, well, I am. You're going to graduate school. So it was, that encouragement meant the world to me. I mean, it basically gave me permission to do what I really would have wanted to do anyway.
Yeah. It so often is a mentor that will start someone on a path.
I owe just about everything that makes me happy in my life to those people and a few others.
Yeah. You write poetry and fiction both, and you also write essays. Which of the genres that you write in did you start with?
I started with fiction. And then I went to poetry. I turned late to essays. I wrote essays, obviously, as a student, but it was more scholarly kinds of things. But when I came to Vermont College 10 years ago, we had to give lectures. And so I started writing up some of the things I'd been telling my students for years. And those are the essays that now appear in the book that's just coming out called Along With All That Could Happen, a collection of essays published by Writer's Digest Books, due out later in July. So that, really, if I hadn't come to Vermont College, I probably would not have written those lectures.
And so the book is a collection of lectures that have been turned to essays, and mm-hmm. Have they all been published?
They've all been published before, most of them, all but one of them, in the Writer's Chronicle.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I have a question about one of your essays in this collection, Along With All That Could Happen. But the subject of the essay was the tendency of contemporary authors to use or overuse the present tense. And the article covers a lot of ground, but I wonder if we can just talk about this a little. What's your biggest criticism of the present tense in contemporary fiction?
Well, before I say that, let me just say that the reason I started to write the essay was that there's been an enormous change in the way people write fiction. Before 1960, there's just really about a half a dozen books that were written in the present tense. And then since 1960, there are literally thousands. It's now the default point tense for most beginning writers. If I teach a writing workshop, at least half or more will write their stories in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to wonder, you know, what was the reason for this, and what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages? And there are a lot of advantages, but there are also some really serious disadvantages. And among them is the fact that, particularly if you have a first-person narrator, that there's this feeling of detachment from what's happening. A person is narrating in the present tense while they're doing something. And that kind of takes us out of the story and makes us feel detached, to be like a quarterback on a football team also doing the play-by-play. You know, here I am stepping back into the pocket, I'm scanning the field for a receiver, now I'm throwing the ball, you know. And I got so many stories like that from students and read so many stories like that when I was an editor for Crazy Horse magazine. And I just see so many stories written in that tense that I started to try to understand it. And I think there are a lot of cultural reasons for it. And the essay is an exploration of that.
Okay. There was a quote in the essay that I'm not going to get right because I'm not looking at it right this second, but mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the idea that any past tense narration has the perspective of at least two people, because the narrator is able to speak from his life today and his or her sure. life from the past.
Right. In a past tense narration, you automatically have a more complex characterization because the narrator is both who he was and who he is. Also, in a present tense narration, there's the tendency to go at the sort of the pace of a clock, keep things moving. And so we don't pause much for characters to think. We don't pause for description. We tend to have a very compressed period of time that's covered. Things shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And the styles of writers shrink, too. One of the things I do in the essay is compare the style of one writer in a story that's in present tense and one of her other stories that's in past tense, and they're just markedly different. And I think to a large extent it has to do with the tense.
Mm-hmm. Is there a book that you can think of that was sort of a breakout book that changed the way people looked at present tense and that people are emulating now, you know?
Absolutely. It was John Updike's Rabbit Run.
Okay.
That's the one that first influenced most people. Charles Dickens actually used the present tense in five or six of his novels, never through an entire novel. Ironically, in David Copperfield, he uses the present tense for the section that's titled Retrospect. That's one of the reasons why I titled this essay Remembrance of Things Present,
okay,
instead of Remembrances of Things Past.
Well, this might be a good time for you to read from that book.
If it's all right, I'll read the first paragraph of some epiphanies about epiphany.
Great.
Okay.
This is David Joss reading from his essay, Some Epiphanies About Epiphanies, From Alone with All That Could Happen, published by Writer's Digest Books, July 2008.
Okay. The first section is entitled God Epiphany. I'll spare you the math. Suffice it to say that in 34 years of teaching creative writing and 11 years of editing literary journals, I have read approximately 40,000 unpublished short stories, not to mention several thousand published ones, and I would conservatively estimate that between a fourth and a third of them featured as their climax that blast of trumpets, choir of angels moment of sudden insight we call an epiphany. So I figure I have vicariously experienced 11 or 12,000 brilliant life-altering insights during my teaching and editing career. But am I even one whit wiser as a result? Well, maybe one whit, but not more. Mostly I'm just weary of all these revelations arriving right on schedule, like trains in a fascist state. And I confess I'm relieved and delighted when I encounter a story that refuses to allow its protagonist even a glimpse of eternal truth. But make no mistake, this is not a diatribe against epiphanies. I happen to love epiphanies, and I've written and still write them myself. But as Flannery O'Connor might have said, a good epiphany is hard to find, and as I can attest, even harder to write. So I've been thinking lately about what makes one epiphany successful and another one not. In this essay, I'll discuss the conclusions I've reached, my epiphanies, in short, about epiphanies.
Aha.
An aha moment, yes.
Now, do you think that people write epiphanies at the end of stories in order to create an ending, you know, to make it feel very final?
Yes, and they're often very forced and unnatural. To a large extent, the tendency toward epiphanies is due to the influence of James Joyce, who was, after all, the one who took the term from its religious context and applied it to literature. Before Joyce, there were many epiphanies in literature, but it certainly was not a dominant tendency. Now there's a lot of it. Also, editors very strongly have come to associate the story and the epiphany as essential, you know, ingredients. See, Michael Curtis from the Atlantic Monthly, for example, says that a story requires an epiphany. So has Rust Hills, who edited Esquire for years. There's been a backlash against this particular kind of, you know, and then suddenly I realized, or then it dawned on her, you know. There's been a backlash against this, particularly with a marvelous essay by Charles Baxter called Against Epiphanies. But one of the reasons I wrote this essay was both to point out the problems with epiphanies, but also to show about 20 different ways that that writers have managed to write really wonderful and convincing epiphanies. Mm.
I want to talk a little bit about your poetry.
Okay.
You have a collection called Improvising Rivers, and in the title poem of that collection, I love the extended metaphor that you use of the jazz that exists in the natural world. And I ask that you read a little bit from that.
I'd be glad to.
So this is David Joss reading Improvising Rivers from his collection of poetry.
Nights I cannot sleep, I improvise rivers, yellow willows drooping over pools where trout drowse, their fins keeping them steady. And overhead the blue river of sky, endless, eddying around islands of clouds. Lying in bed, I listen to the jazz of water's passage over rocks, the rapid fire arpeggios of riffles, the walking bass line of backwater lapping fallen oaks, and threading through it all, in rhythm as syncopated as sun and shadow beneath flickering leaves, the high horn trills of cedar waxwings, a bird I've never seen near any river. So why do I drag its sweet song into this prelude to dream? Because the last time I fished the Norfolk, two turkey vultures flapped past, huge wings slapping the dawn into submission, their heads looking scalded or skinned, red executioner's hoods. And because I love cedar waxwings, the muted beauty of their gold gone gray, their raccoon-masked eyes, and the quaver in their song, that courageous admission of uncertainty. and this river is not the Norfolk or Chippewa, nor any other river I've known, though no doubt these rapids and that limestone bluff, the muskrat, hair slicked back like some 50s rocker, and the stalking crane, all rise like photographs from memory, not will. The known is their current, but these rivers still flow beyond the border of nowhere, that last retreat for those awake too late. And just as they carry me into sleep, I carry them into each day, so that when I rise and look in the mirror, that slowest of rivers, I can see my face drifting down the years like a leaf. And though I cannot know where the river is carrying me or why, I can hear, soft now, then softer still, the music of my passing.
Thank you very much for reading that.
You're welcome.
The metaphor of the jazz that exists in the natural world, I was curious if you remember, did that come to you as a result of listening to jazz, or did that come to you as a result of listening to the sounds outside?
I honestly don't know.
No. I was wondering if you would remember.
One of the poems in this same book is an homage to John Cage. It deals with Cage's famous composition 433, which literally consists of the performer sitting at a piano doing nothing for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which then requires the people in the audience to notice the music of the natural world, the music of shuffling feet, of people rustling in their seats, and so forth. And I think anyone who loves music, and I love it very much, will hear in the natural world the source of those music. We get drum beats and rhythms and so forth right from nature.
Do you think that you have to be careful when you use metaphor to sometimes avoid either too much comparing between two things?
Yeah, I think that's always the difficulty. When is enough, when is too much? In my case, metaphors don't come that easily, so when they do come, I'm very grateful.
Your story collection, Black Maps, won the Associated Writing Program's Award for Short Fiction. What's the process like for winning that award? Is that a submission process on the part of the author or a nominating process?
It's a submission process. The judge that year was Lori Moore, and she selected my manuscript, and so it was published by the following year by University of Massachusetts Press, which has an agreement with AWP to publish the winner of that contest.
Do you submit your work still to many prizes and awards?
No, I don't. I would only submit a book to a prize contest. I guess I'm kind of old-fashioned. I believe that we shouldn't have to pay to have our work read.
What's your advice to writers? I mean, you just gave us that wonderful advice, but I'm curious, do you think writers should try for prizes, or particularly beginning writers, should they work toward publication or prizes?
Well, I think prizes are wonderful for calling attention to things. When I was first writing, I won the California Quarterly Short Story Contest, and that story appeared in the O. Henry collection, and I don't think the editors of the O. Henry would have even noticed it if it hadn't won the prize. But back in those days, you didn't have to pay $15 or $25 just, to have a chance at it. And I know that from having worked with several literary magazines over the years that they need to raise money, and prizes are an important way to do it. And I know that the prizes are legit. I know there may be some that aren't. I know people frequently have paranoid fears that it's all rigged and so forth, but I believe they're on the up and up. At least 99.9% of them. The problem is that there are so many people submitting to those contests. I don't want to bet my money on them. I think writers should be paid for their work rather than pay.
Right.
Old-fashioned, I know.
There was an article in Poets and Writers several months ago about that subject. That I should be paid for my work.
I think it was Steve Almond's.
You've said, in I believe it was in a past interview, that you don't tend to write about your own life, but that you prefer writing your way into many characters whose lives mm-hmm. you know nothing or next to nothing about.
Sure.
So do you research the types of people you know nothing about, or do you rely mainly on your imagination?
I rely mainly on my imagination. I will do whatever research is absolutely necessary. For example, I wrote one story that's set in Vietnam during the Vietnam War from the point of view of a soldier. I've never been in the military. The closest I came was to go through a draft physical, and that's as close as I wanted to be. That was a major event of my generation. I knew people had gone there. I'd heard stories, and all of those details sort of rattling around in my head. And so I wrote a story in which a character, you know, is a soldier in Vietnam. And I found I had to do almost no research at all, because the kind of research that I was doing was simply listening to what people said, watching the news, reading newspapers.
Living in your world.
So forth, yeah, just being alive.
Right.
There were just a few things that I had to find out. And they're the sorts of details that convince the experts. If you can get every detail in your story, every specific deal right, then the people who really know about that experience will fill in all the gaps for you. I needed to know what brand of beer the men drank when they were not out on a mission. And I found out it was Carling Black Label. Okay. So if I put in the wrong beer name, mm-hmm. or just said generic beer, I lose some authority, and the people who know fill it in.
Mm-hmm.
I found out this most particularly very early on when I wrote a story that was set in Guatemala, and I received a letter from a poet who was living in Guatemala, and he wrote to tell me how much he loved the story, and as I read this letter, my head was swelling and so forth. And then he said something that really struck me. He says, "I really love your beautiful description of the jicaro and coyol trees, which I never described." I didn't know what the names of trees were, so I looked them up and I put them in. He knew what they looked like, so he was able to picture them. I only know the names.
Wow.
Right? And that's when I realized that all you have to do is get the details right, and if you can fool the people who really know the subject, they'll accept everything else.
Yeah.
The experts are the easiest ones to fool.
Because they have all that information right there.
Because they have the rest of it there. Mm-hmm. They bring it to the story.
I remember in the preface to the Best American Short Stories that Barbara Kingsolver edited, she said that there was a story that she very, very nearly chose, and then she got to a detail that was inaccurate, and that just blew it for her. That
mm-hmm.
was it.
Mm-hmm. I had a student write a story set in Vietnam once, and at one point in the story, the character makes a long-distance phone call from Saigon to Ho Chi Minh City, not knowing that Saigon and Ho Chi Minh City are the same city. Essentially, he's calling long distance to where he was, but in the future. Everything else seemed pretty fine.
Who are some of your favorite writers, Dave?
Boy, that's the question that gets harder and harder to answer as I get older, because there are just so many of them. I think the greatest living writer right now is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I don't think there's really too much doubt that he's one of the greatest writers who's ever lived and deserves to be mentioned along with Shakespeare and the others. I'm very fond of Russian writers. Chekhov is very important to me. I go back to him all the time. He's the best company that I know. I love Dostoevsky as well. Faulkner, Hemingway. There's just such a long list.
When you read the Russian writers, do you have certain translators you turn to, or have you been disappointed in certain translations at all?
I've been very disappointed with some translations, but it's not because I know the Russian or anything and think that they've made mistakes. It just that it doesn't read that well in English. There have been some translations by, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Richard Pever and his wife, who has a Russian name that I've forgotten at the moment. but their translations are wonderful. Mm-hmm. For example, the title of the first section of the Brothers Karamazov is, in Constance Garnett's translation, The History of a Family. Actually, the actual Russian word is the word for family, but it's in the diminutive, and it's scornful. It's a mocking, ironical connotation. And I read an essay in which one of the translators said there was no way to capture that tone in that title. However, Richard DePeaver came up with A Nice Little Family, which captures the tone. Mm-hmm. Right? So a good translator has to not just get the words right and the meaning, but also has to get the tone, and that's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. I would think it'd be fun too, mm-hmm. to have that challenge.
Yes.
What are you writing now?
I'm trying to finish a collection of short stories. The first thing I have to do is finish reading proofs for an anthology of craft lectures by the Vermont College of Fine Arts faculty that will be coming out in December from Writer's Digest Books. It's called Words Overflown by Stars. The title comes from a Paul Celan poem. And it consists of 32 essays on the writing of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction by past and present faculty of the program. So as soon as I finish that, I'm back to working on finishing the collection of stories.
Are you the sole editor of that?
I am, yes.
Okay. So for writers who might be listening, I'm curious if you have any exercise or activity that you turn to in your work when you're maybe stuck or a piece of writing refuses to move forward.
Mm-hmm. When I'm stuck, I consider that not writer's block, but I consider it part of the process. I think it's the story telling me I'm doing something wrong. And so I try to sort of surprise the story by doing something completely different to it, writing a scene from a different point of view, for example, trying to do something stylistically different with the passage. But in the most extreme case, what I do is simply reverse everything. In one story that I wrote about a year or so ago, originally it was about a young man who's had recently been married and his wife was now pregnant with their first child. And the story, I finished the draft, but it just wasn't working. And finally decided just to reverse it. And I made it about an older retired man who had lost his child when he was a teenager. So instead of a child about to be born, there's one that's dead. Instead of a young man, there's an old man. I also moved the story from Arkansas to Minnesota, and then the story came.
Hmm.
So they're just little tricks. Robert Lowell used to do something similar. When he revised his poems, he would simply insert a word that changed the meaning of the line, reversed it, you know, a no or a never or something of that sort. That idea of contradicting what your imagination first gave you can be really, really fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
As Simone Weil once said, contradiction is the lever of transcendence. A quote that I use in an essay on the role of contradiction in the creative process that's in Alone with All That Could Happen.
And are you going to have an essay in the Vermont College of Fine Arts book of essays?
I am. It will be the one on point of view.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dave Joss. Next week, tune in at the same time to hear an interview with the poet, Jody Gladding. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Mystery author Linda Greenlaw will read from Fisherman's Bend, the second book in her Jane Bunker mystery series, at the Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne on Sunday, July 27th. The Green Mountain Writers Conference, a celebration of fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, journalism, nature writing, essay, memoir, personal narrative, and biography, takes place from July 28th to August 1st at the Tinmouth Pavilion on Chipman Lake. For more information, visit www.vermontwriters.com. House of Sand and Fog author Andre Debuse reads from his new book, Garden of Last Days, on Wednesday, July 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont. Allison Cesario Patton, author of the Vermont-based Mrs. Bundle mystery series, returns with her newest mystery, Mrs. Bundle's Maine Vacation, on Saturday, August 2nd, from 1 to 3 p.m. at Borders Books in Burlington. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.